led the way alone, with his own cloud of white dust, and as he rode he kept glancing backwards. The memory of the whole thing still remains vividly in my mind. The horses lifting high their legs as they galloped along, the old man reeling and staggering as he was dragged off by his captors. And so the procession advanced along the road in the white heat of the sun, just like a line of ants. Then it was lost from sight. That night we heard the details from Kijijiro and Mokichi. The guards had appeared before noon. This time the people had no warning of their arrival, and so the samurai rode in, shouting orders to their men, galloping around the village and peering into every corner, while the people fled helter-skelter in confusion. No trace of anything Christian was found. Yet this time they did not give up in despair and withdraw. Instead, the samurai herded the peasants together in one place and declared that unless they made a clean breast of the whole thing, a hostage would be taken. Yet no one spoke a word. "We do not neglect to pay our taxes, and we do our duty to the state." It was the Jii-sama who spoke up to the samurai. "And our burials, too, they are performed in the temple." To this the samurai made no answer. Instead, with his whip he pointed to the Jii-sama, and immediately his men, who were standing in a group behind, threw a rope around the old man and bound him tightly. "Be careful. I want no backchat. We're not here for discussion. An informer has recently told us that amongst you there are secret adherents of this forbidden Christian sect. If anyone will say frankly who these people are, he will receive 100 pieces of silver. But if you don't confess, you must accept the consequences. After 3 days we will come for another hostage. Think it over." The peasants stood erect, silent. Men, women, children, all were silent. And so the seconds passed. It was as if enemies were staring at one another. Looking back on it now, I realize that it must have been precisely at this time, when everything became silent, that we looked down on the village from the mountain. The samurai turned his horse toward the entrance and, brandishing his whip, rode off. The old Jii-sama, bound and trailed along behind the horses, fell, stood up, then fell again. The men would grab hold of him, trying to make him stand up as he was dragged along. Such was the incident of June 5th, just as we heard it. "No, father, we didn't say a word about you," said Mokichi, hands on knees, "and if they come again, we'll still say nothing. No matter what happens, we'll stand by you." He probably said this because he noticed the shadow that passed over our faces, a momentary fear and apprehension. If that was so, how ashamed I feel. Yet even Garp, good-natured in the face of the most terrible difficulties, fixed upon Mokichi a glance that was filled with anguish. "But if this goes on, you'll all end up as hostages," he finally said. "Yes, father, it might turn out that way, but even so, we'll say nothing." "But this is impossible. Rather than such a calamity, it is better for the two of us to get away from this mountain altogether." As he spoke, Garp turned to Mokichi and myself, and to the terrified Kijijiro who sat beside us. "Can't we take refuge in this man's island?" At these words, a spasm of fear crossed the face of Kijijiro, but he said not one word. Looking back on the situation, I see that this cringing, weak-willed fellow, having brought us here, and being embroiled in the whole matter, was in an awful fix. On the one hand, he did not want to lose his reputation as a good Christian, and yet in his little head he was thinking furiously of a way to preserve his life. And so his cunning eyes flashed as he rubbed his hands, just like a fly. He said that the same problem would then arise in Goto, since it would be searched also. Then he kept trying to prove that it would be better to go to some place further removed. But anyhow, no decision was reached that night, and the two men stealthily descended the mountain. The next day, the people of Tomogi were all excited and nervous. Far be it from me to make any criticism of them, but I want to tell you just what Mokichi reported to me. They were split into two factions. One faction insisted that the two of us should move off to a different location. The other said that the village ought to shelter us, come what may. There were even some who said that Garp and myself were responsible for the evil that had befallen the village. In the midst of all this, Mokichi, Ichizo, and Omatsu displayed an unwavering faith. No matter what happened, they would protect the priests. Such was their stand. This confusion gave the authorities the chance they were looking for. On June 8th, they adopted a new approach. This time, it was not a ferocious-looking samurai on horseback who came, but an old samurai with smiling face, accompanied by 4 or 5 followers. He advised the people to weigh the matter carefully, thinking of the pros and cons of the whole thing. He indicated that whoever would honestly reveal the names of the adherents of this Christian sect would obtain a reduction in taxation in the coming years. For these destitute farmers, the thought of a tax reduction must have been alluring indeed. Yet they overcame the temptation. "If you take such a firm stand, I suppose there is nothing for me but to believe you," said the old man, as he laughingly looked back at his followers. "And yet I must ask my superiors which is right, your statement or that of our informer. So we need a hostage. From your number, please select 3 men and send them to Nagasaki tomorrow. Since I am quite confident that you are doing nothing wrong, there is nothing to worry about." In his voice, there was not the slightest hint of intimidation, but everyone knew that it was a trap. And so the men of Tomogi spent that night debating fiercely as to who should be sent to the magistrate's headquarters at Nagasaki. The men selected might never return. Small wonder that even the Tosama and the others who held office flinched. Gathering together in a dark farmhouse, the peasants scrutinized one another keenly. Each seemed to be asking himself secretly how he could escape this terrible role. The name of Kichijiro was mentioned. Probably the reasons for this were, firstly, that he was in a sense a stranger, not a native of Tomogi, and secondly, many harboured the deep feeling that the whole catastrophe had occurred just because of him. Poor weakling. When he saw what was happening, he fell into the most terrible confusion and began to cry. Finally, he broke into abusive language against everyone around. But the others argued that they would have to abandon their wives and children. "You don't belong to this village," they said. "The officials won't cross-examine you so severely. Please go in our place." With clasped hands, they entreated him, until finally, from sheer weakness, he could no longer refuse. So it was decided that he should go. "Let me go too." It was Ichizo who suddenly spoke up. Everyone gasped in amazement. Could this be the silent, stubborn Ichizo they knew so well? And then it was Makichi's turn. He would join the other two, he said. 9th. From morning, a light, drizzling rain had kept falling. The trees in front of our hut could scarcely be seen, wrapped as they were in the grey mist. The three climbed up to the wood. Mokichi seemed a little excited. Ichizo, his eyes narrowed as always, was sullen and silent. Behind the other two was Kichijiro, looking like a whipped dog, pitifully glaring at me with eyes that seemed filled with resentment. "Father, if we are ordered to trample on the Fumi," Mokichi, head hanging, mumbled the words as though he was talking to himself, "it's not only a matter that concerns us. If we don't trample, everyone in the village will be cross-examined. What are we to do?" At this, such a feeling of pity welled up within my breast that without thinking I gave an answer that I know you would never give. I thrust from my mind the memory of how Father Gabriel, during the persecution at Unzen, when dragged before the Fumi, had cried out, "I had rather this foot were cut off than that I should trample on this image." I know that many Japanese Christians and fathers have manifested such feelings when the holy picture was brought before their feet, but was it possible to demand this from these 3 unfortunate men? "Trample! Trample!" I shouted. But immediately I realized that I had uttered words that should never have been on my lips. Garp looked at me reproachfully. Kichijiro was still snivelling. "Why has Deosama given us this trial? We have done no wrong," he cried. We were silent. Mokichi and Ichizo also remained silent. Their eyes seemed fixed on a speck in the empty sky. So, all together, we joined in a last prayer, and when we had finished, the three men descended the mountain. Garp and I watched the figures as they disappeared into the mist and were lost from sight. Never again was I to meet Mokichi and Ichizo. Again, it is a long time since I wrote to you. I have already described how the officials descended upon Tomogi, but I had to wait until now to be able to continue with the details about the cross-examination of the three Christians at Nagasaki. We multiplied our prayers to heaven that they, together with the Jisama, might be restored to us in safety. Night after night, the people of the village offered up their prayers for this intention. I do not believe that God has given us this trial to no purpose. I know that the day will come when we will clearly understand why this persecution, with all its sufferings, has been bestowed upon us, for everything that our Lord does is for our good. And yet, even as I write these words, I feel the oppressive weight in my heart of those last stammering words of Kijidiro on the morning of his departure. Why has Deus-sama imposed this suffering upon us? And then the resentment in those eyes that he turned upon me. Father, he had said, what evil have we done? I suppose I should simply cast from my mind these meaningless words of the coward. Yet why does his plaintive voice pierce my breast with all the pain of a sharp needle? Why has our Lord imposed this torture and this persecution on poor Japanese peasants? No. Kijijiro was trying to express something different, something even more sickening. The silence of God. Already 20 years have passed since the persecution broke out. The black soil of Japan has been filled with the lament of so many Christians. The red blood of priests has flowed profusely. The walls of the churches have fallen down, and in the face of this terrible and merciless sacrifice offered up to him, God has remained silent. This was the problem that lay behind the plaintive question of Kijijiro. Anyhow, let me simply tell you about the fate that befell us after this. The three men were summoned to the magistrate's office at a place called Sakuradai. For 2 days they were left lying in the prison at the back of the place, until finally they were brought out for questioning. For some reason or other, the questioning began with a strangely mechanical question and answer. You know that Christianity is an outlawed religion? Mokichi, spokesman for the others, nodded his assent. A report has been sent in that you are practicing this outlawed religion. What have you to say? All three answered that they were convinced Buddhists, living in accordance with the teaching of the monks at the Dana Temple. The next step was, if that is so, trample on the fumi. A board, to which was attached an image of the Virgin and Child, was placed at their feet. Following my advice, Kichijiro was the first to place his foot on the image. After him, Mokichi and Ichizo did likewise. But if they thought that only by this would they be pardoned, they were greatly mistaken. Slowly there appeared on the faces of the watching officials faint smiles. What had caught their attention was not the actual fact of the Christians placing their foot on the fumi, but the expressions on their faces as they did so. You think you can deceive us like that? Said one of the officials, an old man. And now, for the first time, the three recognized him as the old samurai who'd ridden into Tomogi some days before. Do you think we are fools? Do you think we didn't notice how heavy and nervous your breathing became? We are not excited, Mokichi exclaimed earnestly. We are not Christians. Well, let us try one more way, came the answer. And with this, the order was given that they should spit on the crucifix and declare that the Blessed Virgin was a whore. Only afterwards did I hear that this was a plan thought out by Inoue, the man whom Valignano had spoken of as being the most dangerous of all. This Inoue, who had at one time received baptism to get advancement in the world, knew well that these poor peasants honoured the Virgin above all. Indeed, I myself, since coming to Tomogi, have been a little worried, seeing that the peasants sometimes seem to honour Mary rather than Christ. Come now, won't you spit on it? Won't you repeat the words as you are told?" Ichizo grasped the fumi in both hands and, as the officials prodded him on from behind, he tried to spit on it, but somehow he was powerless. He could not do it. Kichijiro too hung back, making no movement. "What's the matter with you?" At the fierce urging of the officials, a white tear overflowed from the eye of Mokichi and rolled down his cheek. Ichizo too shook his head as though caught in the throes of pain. Then both of them at last confessed openly that they were Christians. Only Kichijiro, overcome by the threats, gasped out the required blasphemy against the Virgin. "Now spit," came the order. At the command, he let fall on the fumi the insulting spittle that could never be effaced. Following upon this investigation, Mokichi and Ichizo were imprisoned for 10 days in the prison of Sakuradai. As for the apostate Kichijiro, he was set free, and with that, he disappeared from sight. Since that time, he has not returned here. It would be impossible for him to come back. We have now entered the rainy season. Every day the fine drizzle falls unceasingly. Now, for the first time, I come to see what a gloomy pest this rain is, a pest that destroys everything both on the surface and at the root. This district is like a country of the dead. No one knew what fate would overtake our two Christians. Fear that they too would eventually be subjected to the same investigation gripped the people, and almost no one went into the fields to work. And beyond the dreary fields, how black the sea was. 20th. Once again the officials rode into the village, this time with a proclamation. Here, on the beach of Tomogi, Mokichi and Ichizo would be subjected to the water punishment. 22nd. A procession, looking like a long line of peas, could be seen approaching from the distance along the rain-blanketed ashen road. Slowly the tiny figures grew in size. In the midst of the group, their arms bound fast and their heads hanging low, surrounded by guards, rode Ichizo and Mokichi. The people of the village did not venture out from behind the barred doors of their houses. Behind the long procession were a number of stragglers who had joined from the neighbouring villages to view the spectacle. The whole scene could be observed from our hut. Arriving at the shore, the officials ordered a fire to be lighted so that Ichizo and Mokichi could warm their bodies drenched by the rain. And then, as I have been told, with an unwanted sense of pity, someone gave them a cup of sake to drink. When I heard this, I could not help thinking of how one of the soldiers gave to the dying Christ some vinegar on a sponge. 2 trees, made into the form of a cross, were set at the water's edge. Ichizo and Mokichi were fastened to them. When it was night and the tide came in, their bodies would be immersed in the sea up to the chin. They would not die at once. But after 2 or even 3 days of utter physical and mental exhaustion, they would cease to breathe. The plan of the authorities was to let the people of the village of Tomogi, as well as the other peasants, get a good view of this prolonged suffering, so that they would never again approach the Christian faith. It was already past noon when Mokichi and Ichizo were fastened to the trees, and the officials, leaving 4 guards to watch, withdrew on horseback. The onlookers also, who had at first come in great numbers to watch the spectacle, now gradually departed. The tide came in. The 2 forms did not move. The waves, drenching the feet and lower half of their bodies, surged up the dark shore with monotonous roar, and with monotonous roar again receded. In the evening, Omatsu, together with her niece, brought food to the guards and asked if they might give the 2 men something to eat. Receiving this permission, they now approached in a small boat. "Mokichi! Mokichi!" cried Omatsu. "What is it?" Mokichi is said to have replied. Next, "Ichizo! Ichizo!" she said. But the aged Ichizo could make no answer. yet that he was not dead was clear from the occasional slight movement of his head. "You are suffering terribly, but be patient. Padre and all of us are praying. You will both go to paradise." Such were Omatsu's words of earnest encouragement. But when she tried to put the potato she had brought into Mokichi's mouth, he shook his head. If he must die anyway, he seemed to feel, he would like to escape as quickly as possible from this torment. "Give it to Ichizo," he said. "Let him eat. I can endure no more." Omatsu and her niece, distraught and tearful, returned to the shore, and here, drenched by the rain, they raised their voices and wept. Night came. The red light of the guards' blazing fire could be seen faintly even from our mountain hut, while the people of Tomogi gathered on the shore and gazed at the dark sea. So black were the sea and the sky that no one knew where Mokichi and Ichizo were. Whether they were alive or dead, no one knew. All, with tears, were praying in their hearts. And then, mingled with the sound of the waves, they heard what seemed to be the voice of Mokichi. Whether to tell the people that his life had not yet ebbed away, or to strengthen his own resolution, the young man gaspingly sang a Christian hymn, "We're on our way, we're on our way, we're on our way to the Temple of Paradise, to the Temple of Paradise, to the Great Temple." All listened in silence to the voice of Mokichi. The guards also listened. And again, amid the sound of the rain and the waves, it broke upon their ears. 24th. The drizzle continued all day, while the people of Tomogi, again huddled together, stared from afar at the stakes of Mokichi and Ichizo. The shore, enveloped by rain, stretched out wearily, like a sunken desert. Today there came no Gentile spectators from the neighbourhood. When the tide receded, there only remained in the distance the solitary stakes to which were fastened the two men. It was impossible to distinguish between the stakes and the men. Mokichi and Ichizo adhered to the stakes in such a way that they became part of them. The only indication that they were still alive was the dark moaning of a voice, which sounded like that of Mokichi. The moaning sometimes ceased. Mokichi had not even the strength to encourage himself with a hymn like that of yesterday. Yet after an hour of silence, the voice was again brought to the ears of the people by the wind. Hearing this sound, like that of an animal, the peasants trembled and wept. In the afternoon, the tide gradually comes in again. The black, cold colour of the sea deepens. The stakes seem to sink into the water. The white, foaming waves, swirling past the stakes, break on the sand. A white bird, skimming over the surface of the sea, flies far, far away. And with this, all is over. They were martyred. But what a martyrdom! I had long read about martyrdom in the lives of the saints, how the souls of the martyrs had gone home to heaven, how they had been filled with glory in paradise, how the angels had blown trumpets. This was the splendid martyrdom I had often seen in my dreams. But the martyrdom of the Japanese Christians I now describe to you was no such glorious thing. What a miserable and painful business it was. The rain falls unceasingly on the sea, and the sea which killed them surges on uncannily, in silence. In the evening, the officials again arrived on horseback. At their command, the guards gathered damp pieces of wood, and removing the bodies of Mokichi and Ichizo from the stakes, began to burn them. This they did to prevent the Christians from bringing home the remains for veneration. When the bodies were reduced to ashes, they threw them into the sea. The flame they had kindled flared red and black in the breeze. The smoke flowed over the sandy beach, while the people, without the slightest movement, vacantly watched its undulations. When all was over, heads hanging like cows, they shuffled back to their homes. Today, while writing this letter, I sometimes go out of our hut to look down at the sea, the grave of these two Japanese peasants who believed our word. The sea only stretches out endlessly, melancholy and dark, while below the grey clouds there is not the shadow of an island. There is no change, but I know what you will say. Their death was not meaningless. It was a stone which in time will be the foundation of the church, and the Lord never gives us a trial which we cannot overcome. Mokichi and Ichizo are with the Lord. Like the numerous Japanese martyrs who have gone before, they now enjoy everlasting happiness. I also, of course, am convinced of all this. And yet why does this feeling of grief remain in my heart? Why does the song of the exhausted Mokichi, bound to the stake, gnaw constantly at my heart? We're on our way. We're on our way. We're on our way to the Temple of Paradise. To the Temple of Paradise. To the Great Temple. I have heard from the people of Tomogi that many Christians, when dragged off to the place of execution, sang this hymn, a melody filled with dark sadness. Life in this world is too painful for these Japanese peasants. Only by relying on the Temple of Paradise have they been able to go on living. Such is the sadness which fills this song. What do I want to say? I myself do not quite understand. Only that today, when, for the glory of God, Mokichi and Ichizo moaned, suffered and died, I cannot bear the monotonous sound of the dark sea gnawing at the shore. Behind the depressing silence of this sea, the silence of God. The feeling that while men raise their voices in anguish, God remains with folded arms, silent. This may well be my last report. This morning we got word that the guards are getting ready to comb the mountains. Before this search can get underway, we have got the hut back to its original condition and have done away with every trace of our hiding there. So now we leave the hut. And where will we go? Neither Garp nor I have yet decided. For a long time we talked the thing over, wondering if we should flee together or separate. Finally we decided that even if one became a prey of the Gentiles, it was better that the other should remain. In other words, we would part company. And yet why on earth do we remain in this country at all? We did not make that long journey around Africa, across the Indian Ocean, onto Macau and then to Japan, just to flee like this from one hiding place to another. It was not to hide in the mountains like field mice, to receive a lump of food from destitute peasants and to be confined in a charcoal hut without being able even to meet the Christians. What had happened to our glorious dream? Yet one priest remaining in this country has the same significance as a single candle burning in the catacombs. So Garp and I vowed to one another that after our separation we should strive might and main to stay alive. Anyhow, if my report now comes to an abrupt end, for all I know you may not even to date have received it, do not think that we are necessarily dead. It is just that in this barren land we must leave one small spade to till the ground. All around me is the black sea. It is impossible to tell where the blackness of night begins. I cannot see whether or not there are islands around me. The only thing that tells me I am on the sea is the heavy breathing of the young man who rows the boat behind me, the sound of the oars in the water, the lapping of the waves against the edge of the boat. 1 hour ago, Garp and I parted. We clambered on board separate little ships and left Tomogi. He went off in the direction of Hirodo. In the pitch darkness, I could not even see him. We did not even have time to say goodbye. Chapter 4. Continued. Left all alone, I trembled from head to foot. It seemed that my body was outside the control of my will. Were I to say that this moment was not filled with dread, I would be telling a lie. No matter how strong one's faith, physical fear can overwhelm one completely. When I was with Garp, we could at least share our fear, as one shares bread, breaking it in two. But now I was all alone in the black sea of the night, and must take upon myself the cold and the darkness and everything else. Have all the Japanese missionaries felt such terror? I wonder about them. And then somehow or other, the mouse-like face of Kichijiro, filled with terror, rose up in my imagination. Yes, that cowardly wretch who had trampled on the Fumi at Nagasaki and fled. Were I an ordinary Christian, not a priest, would I have fled in the same way? What kept me going now might be my self-respect and my priestly sense of duty. I called out to the young man at the oars, asking him for water, but he made no answer. I began to understand that ever since that martyrdom, the people of Tomogi regarded me as a foreigner who had brought disaster to them all, a terrible burden to them. Probably this young man would like to be relieved of the task of rowing me across the waters. To dampen my parched tongue, I began to suck my fingers, wet with seawater, and I thought of Christ nailed to the cross and the taste of vinegar in his mouth. As the ship slowly changed its direction, I could hear the sound of waves breaking against rocks. It was just like the sound of a black drum, and it had been the same at the time of my last crossing. From here the sea went into a deep inlet where it washed the strand of the island, but the whole island was wrapped in thick, thick darkness, nor could I see where the village was. How many missionaries had crossed over to this island on a tiny boat just as I had done, and yet how different were their circumstances from mine. When they came to Japan, fortune smiled gaily upon their every venture. Everywhere was safe for them. They found houses in which they could rest at ease, and Christians who welcomed them with open arms. The feudal lords vied with one another to give them protection, not from any love of their faith, but out of a desire for trade. And the missionaries did not fail to use this chance to extend their apostolic work. For some reason or other, I called to mind the words of Valignano at Macau. At one time, we seriously discussed the question as to whether our religious habit should be made of silk or of cotton. As these words suddenly came into my mind, I looked out into the darkness, and clasping my knees, I laughed softly. Don't misunderstand me. I have no intention of looking down on the missionaries of that time. The only thing is that it seems so ludicrous that this fellow, sitting in an insect-infested little ship, dressed in the peasant clothing of Mukichi from Tomogi, that this fellow should be a priest just like them. Gradually, the black cliffs drew near. From the shore, the smell of rotten seaweed was carried to our nostrils, and when the sand began to grate on the bottom of the ship, my young companion jumped out into the sea and with both hands began to pull the ship up onto the beach. I, too, got into the shallow water, and, breathing deeply of the salty air, I made my way up onto the beach. "Thank you," I said. "The village is above, isn't it?" "Father, I..." Even though I could not see his face, the tone of his voice told me that he did not want to have anything more to do with me. We shook hands, and, deeply relieved, he ran into the sea. The dull sound of his feet as he jumped aboard the ship echoed in the darkness. With the sound of the receding oars echoing in my ears, I thought of Garp. Where was he now? As I walked along the shore, I spoke to myself like a mother soothing her child. What was I afraid of? I knew the way. If I went straight, I should come into the village which had welcomed me. In the distance, I heard something like a low groaning. It was the mewing of a cat, but the only thing I could think of was how to rest my weary limbs and how to put even a little food into my empty stomach. Arriving at the entrance to the village, the low mewing of the cat became even more distinct. Into my nostrils, the wind blew an awful stench which almost made me vomit. It was like rotten fish. But when I set foot in the village, I found myself surrounded by a fearful, eerie silence. Not a single person was there. I will not say it was a scene of empty desolation. Rather was it as though a battle had recently devastated the whole district. Strewn all over the roads were broken plates and cups, while the doors were broken down so that all the houses lay open. The low mewing of the cat from the empty hut seemed somehow impudent, as though the animal was brazenly stalking around the village. For a long time I stood silent and dazed in the middle of the village. Strange to say, I now felt no anxiety, no fear. The only thing that kept repeating itself quietly in my mind was, why this? Why? I walked the village from corner to corner in the deadly silence. Thin, straggly wild cats wandered all over the place, though where they came from I cannot imagine. They would brush past my legs and glare at me with blazing eyes. Parched and famished, I made my way into an empty house in search of food, but in the end the only thing I got was a bowl of water. As I stood there, the day's fatigue got the better of me, and leaning against a wall like a camel, I slept. In the middle of my dreams, I could feel the wild cats walking around my body and tearing at the stinking dry fish as they seized it. At other times, as I opened my eyes, I could see through the broken-down door the thick black sky that held no star. With the cool gust of morning air, I began to cough. Now the sky was white, and the mountains that formed the background to the village could be seen faintly from the hut where I was. It was dangerous to stay here. I would get up. I would go out into the road and leave this desolate place. As on the previous night, the ground was strewn with cups and plates and shreds of clothing. But where was I to go? At any rate, rather than going along by the sea where I would surely attract attention, it seemed safer to take to the hills. Somewhere or other there must be Christians secretly living their life of faith as these people had been doing a month before. I would look for them and find out what had happened here, and after that I would determine what ought to be done. But then, quite suddenly, the thought of Garp rose up in my mind, and I wondered what had befallen him. And so I took a last look around the village, going into the houses. In that desolation, so complete that at times there was scarcely a place to put one's feet, I finally found a little dried rice. This I wrapped in some of the rags lying on the ground, and carrying it with me, I headed for the mountains. I got to the top of the first mountain, the mud, sodden with the drizzle, clinging to my feet, and gradually I began to climb along the rice paddies. How poor were the Christians! With what painstaking care they had tilled the plain soil, dividing the fields with fences of stone. Yet with only this narrow strip of land that ran along beside the sea, it was impossible to live and at the same time pay taxes. Everywhere was the stench of manure on the poor wheat and chestnuts, while swarms of flies attracted by the smell filled the air and sometimes settled on my face to my intense annoyance. At last, as dawn broke and the mountains began to stand out in the sky like the blade of a sword, I could see the flocks of crows cawing raucously as they flew in circles among the white clouds. At the top of the hill, I stopped to look down at the village beneath. A brown clump of earth, a cluster of straw roofs, huts made of mud and wood, not a sign of life on the road nor on the black shore. Leaning against a tree, I looked down on that valley, silvered by the rain. Only the morning sea was beautiful. This sea, holding in its embrace a number of small islands, flashed like a needle in the faint sunlight, while the waves, biting at the shore, foamed white with froth. I recalled how many missionaries had come and gone across this sea and had been received by the Christians. Xavier, Cabral, Valignano, and the rest. Certainly Xavier, when he came to Hirodo, had passed this way. And then Torres, that great and noble Japanese missionary, he too had visited these islands. Yet these men had been loved so deeply by the people, had received such a welcome, had had churches which, though small, were beautiful and decorated with flowers. They had had no need to fly to the mountains for hiding like haunted men. When I reflected on my own condition, a strange desire to laugh rose up within my heart. Today again the sky was clouded. It looked as if it was going to be hot. Crows circled over my head persistently, and when I stopped for a moment, their darkly ominous cawing would cease. But when I began to walk, they would come after me again. Sometimes one of them would settle on the branch of a nearby tree, and, fluttering its wings, it would watch me. Once or twice, I threw stones at the cursed birds. About noon, I reached the foot of the crescent-shaped mountain. I kept choosing a road from which I would not lose sight of the sea and the coast. I wondered if there were any villages on those islands in the sea. In the murky sky, rain clouds flowed slowly along like huge ships. I sat down in the grass and began to chew the dried rice I had stolen from the village and cucumbers I had picked up along the way. The juice of these cucumbers restored my strength and courage somewhat. The wind was blowing over the fields, and then, when I closed my eyes, I sensed the smell of something burning. I stood up. It was the remains of a fire. Someone had passed this way before me and had gathered twigs to light a fire. I put my fingers into the ashes and found some sense of warmth remaining at the heart. For a long time I pondered. Should I go back or go on? I had spent but one day without meeting a single person, wandering through that desolate village and these brown mountains. It had only been a day, yet now I seemed to have lost my energy and courage. Any man at all, if only he was a man, I would like to meet him. Such was my first thought, followed by a realization of the dangers that such a course of action would bring. But at last, after long reflection, I yielded to the temptation. Even Christ, I reflected, could not overcome this temptation, for he descended from the mountain and called men to his side. I could tell immediately the direction in which the man who lit the fire had gone. Only one route was possible, the opposite direction from that along which I had come. Looking up at the sky, I saw the white sun flashing in the murky clouds, in which the crows were cawing with raucous voices. Carefully, I hastened my steps. Over the plain were scattered all kinds of trees. Sometimes they took on the shape of a man, and I, all confused, would come to a standstill, while the hoarse cawing of the pursuing crows kept arousing in me an ominous and ugly presentiment. To distract my attention, I kept on walking, looking carefully at the various trees as I passed. From childhood, I have loved botany, and since coming to Japan, I have been able to distinguish immediately all kinds of trees that I know. There are some trees which God has planted in every country, but here I found others of a kind I had never set eyes on until now. In the afternoon, the sky brightened a little, reflecting tiny clouds in the pools of blue and white water which remained on the ground. Squatting down, I stirred the water to dampen my neck, now bathed in sweat. The clouds disappeared from the water, and instead there appeared the face of a man. Yes, there, reflected in the water, was a tired, hollow face. I don't know why, but at that moment I thought of the face of yet another man. This was the face of a crucified man, a man which for so many centuries had given inspiration to artists. This man none of these artists had seen with his own eyes, yet they portrayed his face, the most pure, the most beautiful that has claimed the prayers of man and has corresponded with his highest aspirations. No doubt his real face was more beautiful than anything they have envisaged. Yet the face reflected in this pool of rainwater was heavy with mud and with stubble. It was thin and dirty. It was the face of a haunted man filled with uneasiness and exhaustion. Do you realize that in such circumstances a man may suddenly be seized with a fit of laughing? I thrust my face down to the water, twisted my lips like a madman, rolled my eyes, and kept grimacing and making ludicrous faces in the water. Why did I do such a crazy thing? Why? Why? In the woods, a cicada was singing hoarsely. Everywhere else was silent. The sun gradually grew weak. The sky clouded again, and as the shadows lengthened on the plain, I gave up hope of ever catching up with the man who had built the fire. Weary it proved, the reckless way of ruin, lonely were the wastes we travelled. Only the words of the scripture arose in my heart, and I sang them to myself as I dragged my feet along. The sun rises and the sun goes down, and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes round to the north. Round and round goes the wind. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. But now there arose up within my heart, quite suddenly, the sound of the roaring sea, as it would ring in my ears when Garp and I lay alone in hiding on the mountain. The sound of those waves that echoed in the dark like a muffled drum, the sound of those waves all night long as they broke meaninglessly, receded, and then broke again on the shore. This was the sea that relentlessly washed the dead bodies of Mokichi and Ichizo, the sea that swallowed them up, the sea that, after their death, stretched out endlessly with unchanging expressions. And like the sea, God was silent. His silence continued. No, no, I shook my head. If God does not exist, how can man endure the monotony of the sea and its cruel lack of emotion? But supposing, of course supposing, I mean, from the deepest core of my being, yet another voice made itself heard in a whisper. Supposing God does not exist. This was a frightening fancy. If he does not exist, how absurd the whole thing becomes. What an absurd drama become the lives of Mokichi and Ichizo, bound to the stake and washed by the waves. And the missionaries who spent 3 years crossing the sea to arrive at this country, what an illusion was theirs. Myself, too, wandering here over the desolate mountains, what an absurd situation. Plucking the grass as I went along, I chewed it with my teeth, suppressing these thoughts that rose nauseatingly in my throat. I knew well, of course, that the greatest sin against God was despair, but the silence of God was something I could not fathom. The Lord preserved the just man when godless folk were perishing all around him. Escape he should when fire came down upon the cities of the plain. Yet now, when the barren land was already emitting smoke, while the fruit on the trees was still unripe, surely he should speak but a word for the Christians. I ran, slipping down the slope. Whenever I slowed down, the ugly thought would come bubbling up into consciousness, bringing an awful dread. If I consented to this thought, then my whole past to this very day was washed away in silence. I felt a drop of water on my cheek, and looking up saw a huge black cloud, like a finger, floating across the surface of a sky that had now become leaden and murky. The drops became more numerous, until at last a blanket of rain enveloped the whole plain like the strings of a harp. Catching sight of a copse of trees quite near to me, I ran into them with all speed. Out flew a number of birds like an arrow from the bow, and sped off in search of shelter. The rain struck the leaves where I stood, making a noise like pebbles pattering on a roof. My peasant clothes were completely drenched. The treetops, swaying in the silver rain, looked just like seaweed. And then, far beyond those swaying branches on the shore, I caught sight of a hut. Probably the villagers had built it as a place for cutting wood. The rain stopped as suddenly as it had started. Once again the plain became white, and the birds began to sing, as though wakened from sleep. Great drops of rain continued to fall from the leaves of the trees, and I, wiping from my forehead the water which was flowing down into my eyes, approached the hut. As soon as I looked inside the door, I was greeted with a foul stench, and I saw a cloud of flies swarming around the entrance. They were clustering around some human excrement. I realized immediately that not too long before a man had been here, had rested, and had gone on his way. But truth to tell, I felt angry at the fellow who had been so uncivilized as to use the only shelter in such a way. But the situation had its ludicrous side too, and I burst out laughing. My apprehension about this fellow grew less. Stepping further inside, I saw that the wood was still smouldering. I was glad that there was a remnant of fire before which I could dry out my drenched clothing. Even if I spent some time here, I felt, it would not be too difficult to catch up with the fellow in front, for obviously he was not travelling fast. When I left the hut, The plain and the trees that had sheltered me were bathed in golden light, while the leaves of the tree, now dry like sand, were filled with song. Picking up a withered branch, I used it as a staff and proceeded on my way until finally I arrived at the slope from which could be seen the coastline down below. There was no change in the languid sea, sparkling like a needle and biting at the curved strand like the huge arc of a bow. One part of the coast held milk-white sand, while another formed an inlet of black rocks. Within the inlet was a tiny landing place where three or four fishing boats were pulled up on the sand. To the west was a fishing village surrounded by trees. It was the first sign of a community I had seen since morning. Sitting down on the slope, I clasped my knees and looked intently at the village with the bold stare of a wild dog. Perhaps the fellow who had left the firewood in the hut had gone down into this village, and I also could run down the slope following in his footsteps. But was this a Christian village? I strained my eyes for any sign of church or cross. Valignano and the other missionaries at Macau had warned us not to imagine that the churches in this country were the same as those at home. The feudal lords had told the priests to use as churches the mansions and temples that were already there. Indeed, it sometimes happened because of this, that the peasants confused Christianity with Buddhism, thinking that they were the same thing. Even Xavier, because of the mistake of an interpreter, came near to failure on this point. Some Japanese, hearing his sermons, thought that our God was the sun which the people of this country had revered for many generations. Consequently, the fact that I saw no buildings with spires attached did not mean that there were no churches here. Among the mud cabins down below there might well be one that was a church. And it might well be that the poverty-stricken Christians were hungering for a priest to administer the Blessed Sacrament, hear their confessions, and baptize their children. In this desert, from which missionaries and priests have been expelled, the only one who could give the water of life to this island tonight was myself. Yes. Only myself, dressed in these dirty, tattered rags, with my arms clasping my legs. Lord, everything that you have created is good. How beautiful are your dwellings! Violent emotion surged up within my breast, as supporting my body with my staff, I slithered down the slope, still wet from the rain, and ran toward my parish. Yes, this was my parish. This was the charge our Lord had entrusted to me. But as I ran, suddenly from one corner of the village, surrounded by pine trees, there came the voice of a man. It seemed to rise up from the depths of the earth. Staff in hand, I stopped in my traces, only to see clearly the dull red flame of a fire. Instinctively realizing that something had happened, I ran back up the slope down which I had been sliding so fast. There, on the far side of the slope, what did I see? But the figure of a man dressed in grey peasant clothing and fleeing from me with all his might. Then the fellow looked in my direction and came to a standstill. The hollow, terrified face looked at me with something of relief. "Father!" He waved his hand as he shouted the word. Then again, screaming something, he pointed to the village. He was signalling to me with his hand to conceal myself. Running up the hill as fast as I could, I tried to hide myself like a wild animal in the shadow of a great rock. I was panting and trying to control my breathing. I heard the sound of footsteps, and then from between the rocks beyond appeared the dirty, mouse-like little eyes of the fellow watching me. I went to wipe away the perspiration that was rolling down my face, but when I looked at my hand, I saw that it was not perspiration, but blood. I had struck up against something while jumping down. "Father!" From the shadow of the rock, the little eyes were peering at me. "Father, how glad I am to see you!" The servile laugh, the attempt to curry favour, the stubble sticking out from the chin. "It's dangerous here," he said, "but I'll look after you." Silently I looked into that face. Kichijiro, the whipped dog, was smiling at me with furtive eyes, plucking the grass, pushing it into his mouth and biting it with his yellow teeth. "It's terrible," he muttered as he looked down at the village. As I looked at him, it dawned on me that this was the fellow who had lit that fire in the terraced fields, the fellow who had dirtied the hut. But why was he roaming through the mountains just like me? He had trampled on the Fumi. What had he to fear? "Father, why have you come to this island? This is a dangerous place. But I know a village where there are some hidden Christians." I kept staring at him in silence. Every village this fellow passed through had been surprised by the government officials. Suspicions from the past came crowding into my mind. Perhaps he was no more than a decoy. I had heard previously that apostates were used as puppets by the government, and the apostates willingly collaborated as though they felt they could justify their own ugly crime by adding one more to their number. Their way of thinking is akin to that of the fallen angels when they allure people into sin. Evening began to enfold the surrounding mountains, but in the village a red flame of light began to move silently around. Yet there was only silence. The village itself, as well as its inhabitants, seemed to be accepting its suffering without protest. Long inured to suffering, the people could no longer even weep and cry in their pain. For me to abandon the village and go on my way was as painful as tearing the scab off a wound that had just begun to heal. Within my heart, a voice cried out, "You are weak, you are a coward," only to be answered by another telling me not to be carried away by a moment of excitement and sentimentality. "You and Garp are probably the only priests in this whole country. If you die, the Japanese church dies with you. You and Garp must live, no matter how great the injuries and sufferings that this life entails." Yet I wondered if this were just the voice of my own weakness. There arose in my mind a story I had heard while still in Macau. It was about a Franciscan priest who, escaping a martyr's death, had carried on an underground apostolate. But then he had given himself up at the castle of the feudal lord, Omura. Because of his momentary rashness, the whole underground work of the mission was impaired and the safety of the Christians was jeopardized. This story was well known. Its moral was that a priest does not exist in order to become a martyr. He must preserve his life in order that the flame of faith may not utterly die when the church is persecuted. Kichijiro followed after me like a wild dog. When I stopped, he would stop too. "Don't walk so fast," he would shout. "I'm sick. Tell me where you are."